You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
All right, welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner Kent, the editor-in-chief of American Theater. I'm here with
Susie Evans, I'm the senior editor.
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And I know it's been a little while since we've been on. We had a little break there.
Also known as we recorded an interview and then it turned out to not have been recorded. And so we had to,
there was that
stall a little bit.
So we apologize for any delay in the feed of our podcast. We have a good episode for you today. Going to talk a little bit about yet another whitewashing controversy in which a white actor was cast in a prominent role of color in Chicago, Porchlight Theater in the Heights. We'll also talk a little bit about the loss of Zelda Fishhandler, one of the founding mothers of the American theater movement that, as we know it, including TCG itself. And then we'll have an interview with the Dearden brothers, Brandon and Jason Dearden, who are both wonderful actors who, among many other accomplishments, are known for their work in August Wilson's plays. And now they have the unique experience of playing the same role in the same play on opposite coasts. And so Susie did an interview with them about their work in two different productions of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. So we started a column a few months ago on equity, diversity, inclusion, and you're curating / writing it. And there's lots of controversies along this issue. It seems like theaters are still haven't learned. Could you lay out exactly what happened and why? And then maybe we'll talk about the backlash and the response.
Sure. I'll just go linear timeline.
Okay.
So, back in March, the Marriott Theater in Chicago, which uses equity actors, they did a production of Evita with only one Latino actor in the cast. And it was all white for the most part. And then, most recently, Porchlight Music Theater, also in Chicago, they're mounting a production of In the Heights where the lead was cast with an Italian-American actor. And I wrote a response. Well, I asked them if they could send me the breakdown of the ethnic breakdown of the actors in the cast, because when it comes to Latino actors, you can't tell by name or by looking at someone what their heritage is, because Latinos come in black, they come
right.
in Asian.
And their names are, you know, Benjamin Bratt is Latino, so
yeah. So it's very murky. But then they said that they did a wide casting call looking specifically for Latino actors. They cannot confirm the ethnicities of the actors because as a professional organization, because of discrimination laws, they cannot ask an actor what their ethnic background is. And so there's a couple of different layers of complication here.
Right.
And so I asked the book writer of In the Heights, Kiara Hudes, what she thought of this. And she basically said, and I'm paraphrasing it, "You are not trying hard enough if you cannot find Latino actors in Chicago."
Right, right. I mean, it's as diverse in terms of Latino Hispanic actors as New York, which is where the play premiered and is set. So,
yeah, 29%. And also, we also wrote about how the Latino Theater Commons had their 2015 festival there.
Yeah, there's a huge Latino theater community there as well.
Yeah, like, there's Latino companies there. So yeah, it's not like they're starving for that.
And so I wrote a piece called "Whitewash in the Heights, Chicago, You Can Do Better." Rob wrote that headline. Some people from the Chicago community were not happy with that generalization.
Well, I know.
But
headlines, you know.
You have to grab them.
Right.
But it posited that we're at a point where saying we tried hard and we couldn't find anything and we're just going to do the show anyway with white actors, that's offensive, and it would be better if you just didn't do the show at all, because it's better to not have a show rather than have a show with brown face in it. And the excuse of we can't find enough actors just doesn't cut it anymore, because we are becoming more global, and most people do fly in their actors from New York City. And so to say there just are not any actors is very disingenuous.
So I guess the pushback would be like, what, how, if they can't ask in the, they could put in the breakdown the ethnicity of the character, but they can't, as we learned from the Hamilton casting recasting controversy, they can't say seeking only non-white actors. You can't.
Yes.
And in the audition, they can't ask you. So the question is, on where's the onus of responsibility for authentically casting the role? In other words, should they ask around, as frankly, we and a lot of other reporters had to do to figure out if Jack DeCesare, the guy who's playing Usnavi in Chicago, whether he's Latino or has Latino heritage, we had to sort of ask around, is that the best way to do it? Or is that doing an end run? Or I don't.
Well, actually, I did do a quick Google of his last name, and it did show up as being of Italian heritage.
Well,
so there's that. But
that is, but as we've just said,
name does not mean anything.
Does not mean anything. I mean, it doesn't mean something, but it means he's got Italian heritage. But he could also have other heritage.
Well, I'm thinking of, this isn't exactly a theater example, but it goes on your asking around thing. When I was doing that story, it's TV, it's not theater, but it's sort of related. That story on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. They were talking about casting the girlfriend character, who's a Latina character. And for some reason, I mean, they were casting in LA, and LA also has a big Latina community. But they were having trouble finding someone who was perfectly right. And so one of the cast of that show was friends with Lin-Manuel. They'd worked on a show together. And so she had Lin-Manuel and Alex Lacamoire, who's orchestrator of In the Heights, and Hamilton, send a list of actors and actresses who they liked, and they ended up casting that way, just based on like going to the source of someone who knew musical theater community, who knew the Latin.
So that is kind of a version of asking around.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have an answer. I don't, and Porchlight didn't even necessarily say that. Some people have offered that in their defense. And then someone pointed out also, which I didn't realize, that Sam McKay, is that his name?
Yeah.
Is playing Usnavi in the West End. And he's apparently very good with the hip hop, but he looks very white.
He admitted to being white. But, and then there's another wrinkle on the issue of 5 years. And I was just looking through comments because that's what I do, because I'm a masochist. And 5 years ago, one of the understudies for Usnavi was a half white, half Jamaican actor on Broadway.
He was a replacement, Corbin Blue. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there was the backlash there, and Lynn said, we cast the best actors for the role. I did make this musical for Latino actors, but they got those roles based on talent, not because of a racial prerequisite, which kind of contradicts what Kiara told me in terms of needing to cast a role appropriately in order to provide more roles for Latino actors who don't have a lot of multifaceted roles to play. And
well, I think that I, again, I'm not trying to speak for Lin-Manuel or other folks, but the argument could be made that we're not talking about bone deep authenticity. We're talking about Corbin Blue as an actor of color. And again, it gets slippery, perhaps, if you want to think of it that way, as like, oh, so a Cuban could play a Mexican, a Jamaican could play. Like, the point is that white actors have a lot of roles to play, right?
Yes.
And I think actors of color, broadly defined, I mean, this is one thing that's coming up with the Hamilton recasts on Broadway and in Chicago. I noticed that Amanda Gonzalez, who was so great in The Heights, is going to play Angelica Schuyler on, I think, Broadway. Is that right?
Mm-hmm, on Broadway. Yeah. It's Karen Olivo.
And so there's no, and Karen Olivo. So there's no requirement that says that part has to be played by an African American just because Renee Elise Goldsberry played it, but it is a person of color. So you can get drawn into these arguments about like, what about this? What about that? But I think if you just keep in mind that there are plenty of musical theater roles for Caucasians and white folks, and reserving them for people of color more broadly is kind of the idea. I know within The Heights it's different than Hamilton, because in The Heights it's supposed to be about an authentic Latino experience, and mostly Latino. There's some black characters in the show too. So, I mean, that would be one defense you could say. It's still a person of color. Someone else pointed out there's another, I don't remember her name, who was cast in the show as well, in a secondary cast, who was not Latino but had like African-American background.
Well, yeah, and my friend Courtney was in a cast of Broadway in the Heights, and she's, I believe, half German, half Vietnamese, and she played a Latino character in the Heights.
That's broadening the person of color a little bit. Yeah.
When it comes to talking to artists of color about these issues, I think I don't want to speak for anyone, but the feeling that I get for the most part is artists of color tend to be grouped into one big category just because of the lack of representation within the separate ethnic subgroups versus white artists. A lot of people were saying, well, if Hermione in Harry Potter on the West End can be black, why can't it be the other way around?
Right.
But that's a false equivalency, as we've previously discussed, because artists of color are very rarely casted in roles that have traditionally been quote unquote white, even when those roles are not racially prescribed. And so, if it doesn't go both ways equally, then and there's a lack of opportunity on one side, then we need to equal the playing field first before we can open it up to anyone can play anything.
Right. I mean, look, it's not to say that artists of color should be lumped together into one big group, right? There are distinctions in the ship. And again, this is why
there's more forgiveness when it's a black man playing a Latino character.
But this is why we say colorblind is a terrible word. It's color conscious because you're conscious of what it says, right? You can't just do it willy-nilly.
I feel like there's a hesitancy of theaters when it comes to casting to approach it from the social justice angle of acknowledging that there is a significant lack and we should try to cast based on that inequality. Right. And I wrote about this in my previous column about Broadway in 1617, which is not diverse at all. I think if we're going to make any real headway on these issues, there needs to be intentionality on the parts of producers, such as, you know, Oregon Shakespeare Festival actively has fellowships reserved for artists of color, not because of any discriminatory aspect, but because there is a lack of opportunity and training and for those artists.
Right. Well, I think the thing is that there's an awareness of it, but there's, as you say, if you're thinking about this while you're putting out the breakdown, it's too late. It should be part of your general intentionality of your entire season. I think my favorite comment, we can talk a little bit about the comments and the backlash. My favorite comment, I believe her name was, I don't remember her name. It was on our Facebook page where she said, look, theaters should just not be reaching out to, artists of color to cast authentically. They should also be casting on the town. They should be casting 1776. They should be casting classic musicals and classic plays this way and have a diverse approach to casting all around, and then this might not be an issue when it comes to when you want to cast, quote, authentically. And speaking of, quote, authentically, do you want to talk about some of the response in Chicago?
Sure. The one, Susie and I were talking about this yesterday, but the one that got both of our mouths just wide open was Hedy Weiss's, the theater critic of the Chicago Sun-Times, I believe. She responded on Facebook saying that if Latino actors can only play Latino characters, does that mean like Shylock, like Jewish characters can only play Shylock, which is a false equivalency.
And then she said, do you have to cast out of the Cook County Jail for Macbeth?
It has to be a murderer in Cook County Jail to play Macbeth. And she said it's called acting, which is the classic phrase.
It's a classic phrase, and it's not a compelling point of argument or a valid point of argument. So please stop making those arguments.
Yes. It's called representation as well. It's interesting. We did notice, I don't know if you saw, that she finally then said, look, if you want to hold a town hall, and so we're not hurling insults on social media, that she would happily participate. I haven't heard if anybody's taken her up on that.
I think they are having a town hall.
Victory Gardens is hosting a town hall since Che Yu, the artistic director, is the one who told me about the Facebook comment. I don't know if she's involved, but I believe the town hall is in the next week or so. Mm. And I believe Porchlight released a statement saying that they're going to be more rigorous in the future, and they reached out to the Chicago Inclusion Project and other artist inclusivity groups, Latino groups in Chicago.
Yeah, I do think one thing that's important to note about the backlash here, too, is there was another case of whitewashing with the Prince of Egypt One Night Only reading that got canceled because there was so much backlash. And the statement released by Scott Schwartz, who's Stephen Schwartz's son.
Yeah, it was a Bay Street Playhouse.
Bay Street Playhouse in New York, who is going to direct it. Stephen Schwartz wrote the music. He did the music for Prince of Egypt movie. Most of the lead cast were white actors. The reason they ended up canceling it, because there's no saying the backlash, but a lot of these actors were getting harassed. Hmm. And I don't know if in these cases we should put the onus on the actors.
No,
they were
no.
getting like social media harassed, and they weren't getting paid very much for this one night reading. And he was basically like, I can't ask these actors to basically get taken down on social media for doing something for free.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in all of these instances that I've read, and I do read comment sections, I haven't seen anyone insulting the actors, and I really don't think insulting the actors is fair game.
I don't know.
They can be, like, tweeting at them or commenting on Instagram or trolling them.
Lisa Portis, who knows Jack DeCesare, was concerned that he was being unfairly maligned. I mean, she supports the idea that the Usnavi should be played by a Latino, but... I don't know. It's complicated because I think actors do have to take some responsibility for the way they're cast and the way they put themselves forward, but they don't bear the ultimate responsibility. And, you know, harassing anybody for this stuff, harassing is not the right approach. Arguing, advocating, you know, I do worry about the way social media has been weaponized by people on all sides. Not to make an equivalence between the sides, but it's like, we're all trying to work through this. Some people get it wrong and need to be educated. I would like to see fewer apologies and more people. Like, what was it? Was it Aurora Theater
in Atlanta
that that had a problem, but basically then came forward with a pledge. You know,
it's
a pledge going forward that they would do better and that they should be held to that standard. If more theaters would do that, like Oregon Shakes, and announce their intentions.
Right, and that intentionality was very specific in the case of Aurora. It said, if we mount a culturally specific show, we're going to cast it authentically. We're not going to make excuses for casting a white actor.
It would be great if they
the rest of that statement was, for non-racially specific shows, they're going to cast across the board.
Perfect.
Granted, people say that, so we're just going to to monitor and hold them
but
to it.
But I'm saying, if you put a pledge out, then you have a standard people can hold you to, so...
Exactly. And I would love it if more theaters have similar pledges. It shouldn't be assumed that you're going to cast across racial lines for Noises Off, but then people get very angry when you do all white Noises Off, and then you wonder why people are angry.
Right. Well, unfortunately, I think we'll still be talking about this in the future. So moving along, speaking of theater leaders who did have great intentions and great results, Zelda Fishhandler, who died last week at the age of 91, was one of the pioneers of the movement we take for granted, which is, we call it variously the resident theater movement or the regional theater movement. Her radical idea wasn't hers alone, Margot Jones in Dallas as well, was that there should be a great theater outside New York. There could be, and there was, but there needed to be more, and there'd be support for that. And the idea that there could be real, rather than creating a centralized national theater based in DC or New York, although her theater was in DC, that it could be theater all over the country. I think she was a big advocate of that. Now, she did start Arena Stage, one of the great American companies, with a resident company, a repertory acting company. In DC, ran it for 4 decades, and then had an amazing legacy after that at NYU, leading the Tisch School of Acting. It's generations of actors that are still working today, you know, were under her tutelage. She made a huge imprint. I think it's interesting. Also, the other thing about a point of history was she was also, in 1968, the play The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones and Jane Alexander was the first nonprofit production to come to Broadway. Now, that was seen as a great triumph. Of course, in the years since, it's
become standard.
Well, it's become standard, and also people said, "Well, was that the beginning of the end? Was that?" I've heard some people say that was.
Wasn't that James Earl Jones' first time on Broadway too, or was that Othello?
I think it probably was. I think it was his first time on Broadway. 68.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up.
He did Othello really early too.
He did Othello very early, and you know, but he was part of that company. He was part of that repertory company, and they were one of the first to do that. So she, of course, she wouldn't accept that, that characterization as it being a bad thing. I think she through to the end of her life, she was advocating for a theater that worked outside, a real nonprofit theater that worked outside the profit motive and worked outside, the capitalist, ethos of making a buck.
We're wrong on both counts on James Earl Jones.
Yes.
His first Broadway show was The Sunrise at Campo Bello in 1958.
Where does Great White Hope fall in?
Great White Hope falls in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th show on Broadway in 1968.
Yeah. All right. So
he's been around.
He's been around for a long time. He was just in a musical last week at Encores. God bless you, Mr. Rosewater.
He can sing?
I don't know if he can sing.
I didn't see it. He had to sing in it. I didn't see it either.
I just know he's still extremely active as an actor. In any case, the one thing that struck me, I just say real briefly, is that with the constant push for gender parity in the American theater, it's striking how two of the great pioneers, at least two and many more.
Oh, three actually.
Who was the other one?
Nina Vance, who founded the Alley in Houston.
Oh, right. Okay. And Margot Jones, who founded a theater. Doesn't exist anymore. His name I forget.
Theater 47.
Theater 47. That's right. And Zelda Fishhandler were all women. It seems like that, and there are plenty of female artist directors now.
Plenty might be a strong word.
My point is they're out there, but when you're asked to sort of go through a list, I was just asked for another story, someone said, "Can we put a woman there?" I said, "Okay, give me a second." It doesn't come to mind immediately because there aren't as many, and they're just it's something we need to recover. Basically, the legacy. I don't think Zelda and Margot were all about because for them it was they were running their theaters. But I think they would have been if they were asked now. They look around and say, "Where are all the women? Why are we not running this movement anymore?" But Teresa at TCG here is a woman theater leader. We have theater leaders.
Kind of being a stage is run by
Molly Smith. Yes. I'm sort of stammering about this. There are plenty. There's Carrie Perloff.
It's not parody in terms of theater leaders.
Parody definitely not.
Well, Ellen Richards and Carrie Perloff are currently, I think they're still working on a study about women who lead nonprofit theaters and the parody in that regard. We focused a lot in our reporting on playwrights and directors. But there's a study, and I wrote about it, I think, in my article 2 years ago that they've been working on. Maybe they're almost close to done, but it's about getting more women at the head of theaters because there aren't plenty. There are some.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying, I'm trying to say plenty, like, oh, I can think of them. I don't want to ignore them. So Zelda, we're pulling together some tributes from those who worked and worked with and knew her very well and can speak to. I mean, Peter Marks wrote a beautiful piece in the Washington Post I highly recommend, and I think his headline really says it all. It's almost impossible to overstate Zelda Fisher Handler's impact on American theater, and it's really true. I struggle to find analogies, like the George Washington, but
is there a sports analogy for this? Like, was there just like one home team and then it just spread across? No, I don't know.
You're asking the wrong person.
No, but
sports analogy.
you're not a sports person, Rob?
No. Oh. No. I don't mind playing a few sports, but I couldn't name a coach for you.
Definitely, because I remember a couple of years in 2014, we were talking about like the 50th anniversary of the regional theater movement.
Right, right.
Because most of these theaters were founded in
a lot of them, 63, 64, yeah.
And so this was the infancy of that, and I feel like we almost take it for granted now that there's theater outside of New York.
No, I know, and it's interesting. I think there's even a case to be made that the resident theater movement is really where the pulse of theater is, and that the traffic going of plays and talent going into New York is at least as much, if not more, than the traffic of plays coming out. You know, the seasons where we list the top 10 plays. You
look and playwrights.
At, and playwrights. Well, the top 20 playwrights. We list the top 10 plays. You look at those plays. Yes, most of them are cruising out to they're going to be done in a million theaters around the country because of a big high-profile New York run and awards. But you look at where they originated, almost all of them originated, had their first production or first couple productions in a resident theater.
Right, right. And also just in terms of just playwrights' compensation, how playwrights get paid, they're not getting paid with a Broadway production like Arthur Miller with The Death of a Salesman. The reason Christopher Durang, like his income from playwriting is from all of these regional productions of Vanya.
Yeah, well, a Broadway option is a pretty penny.
Yeah.
As a playwright.
But they're not running for years and years, though.
No, no, they're plays, not. But the plays but the don't. Play plays they don't. Get a pretty big lump sum at the beginning, and then they get some royalties.
They do, yeah. Yes. But I think the just true what she's saying. The economic benefit of a yeah. successful New York run is really in the
licensing is where the money end, is. The mm-hmm. But if it was on Broadway, I mean, it's not enough to live yeah. on. But there's a big chunk of change.
Right, right. So I don't know what Zell would say about all that. I'm sure she all but deplored the influence of the way the profit motive had. To her mind, corrupted the motives of making theater. But, you know, she spoke up for that and lived that her whole life. So we honor her, and we will honor her. You can look online. We'll have more to say on it online. So why don't we go to your interview? Susie, you want to set up your interview with Brandon and Jason Dearden?
Yes. I did an interview with Brandon J. Dearden
and
Jason Dearden. Find out why there's a J at the end of the interview. It's rather amusing. Brandon, they're both actors. They're brothers. And they are both playing Levy in different productions of August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Jason Dearden is playing the role at the Mark Taper Forum with Center Theater Group in a production directed by Felicia Rashad, and that play is running September 1st to October 16th. And then Jason Dearden is not Brandon yeah. Dearden. Brandon. They both have like the names at the end. Brandon Dearden is playing Levy in a production directed by Ruben Santiago Hudson at Two River Theater in New Jersey from September 10th to October 9th. And both of they've starred in August Wilson together before. They both did The Piano Lesson at Signature. Brandon directed a production of Seven Pianos that starred Jason at Two River.
Seven guitars.
They both worked with Ruben Santiago a bunch. It's an interesting conversation. They know each other well, and they're used to working together, and they're missing their brother.
Oh, so I'm editing that conversation right now, Susie, but did you ask them how old they are? What the age gap is?
I didn't ask them how old they are, but I know it. I think Brandon is 2 years older. I think Brandon's 35 and Jason's 33.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they're a little older. Yeah. And it's interesting they're playing the same role because I think of them as slightly different types.
Although, they are,
you
yeah.
know, they're actors.
Their dad was an actor, and so he's kind of who got them.
Their dad?
I forget what his name is, but they grew up in Houston. Brandon actually played a little boy in one of August Wilson's plays. And
that's
I'm remembering
right.
when he was young at the
that's
Alley
right.
Theater. Mm-hmm. And Jason remembers seeing Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Was Joe Turner's Come and Gone? There's a little boy in that.
Okay. He went into audition for A Christmas Carol, I think.
Yeah.
And they were like, there's nothing right for you. And he was so bummed. And then they were like, but you're right for this part.
And he never, I don't think he'd heard of August Wilson. He's like, oh my
he
God.
Had
and that,
it,
that's
yeah.
where he discovered
And then he, he said this. I hope we kept this on audio because We had some audio problems in the middle of it, but I hope we capture this. He did, I think it was Joe Turner's at the Alley when he was young, and this older actor came up to him and was like, remember August Wilson, he's going to feed your family someday.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a fun conversation.
It's great, yeah.
You know, if you're on the West Coast, see Jason, and if you're on the East Coast, see Brandon.
Sounds good. So we'll be back after that with some recommendations.
I'd like to welcome Brandon Dearden and Jason Dearden to American Theater's Off Script. The actors and brothers will be playing the same role of Levy in two different productions of August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom at the same time this fall. Jason will be playing the role at Center Theater Group in a production directed by Felicia Rashad, and Brandon will be playing the role at Two River Theater in New Jersey in a production directed by Ruben Santiago Hudson. So welcome, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah. So how did this come about that you're both playing the same role at the same time? Was it a coincidence? Was it a role that you both always wanted to play? How did this come about this fall?
A little bit of both. This is Jason saying a little bit of both. You know, the universe is funny like that. I think both of us have been eyeing this role for a while, ever since we were introduced to the play. And funny enough, we actually used to do it in high school at drama tournaments, just a monologue, an excerpt from the play.
You both used to do it in drama school?
Yeah. Brandon first.
You did it, Jason? I didn't know you did this.
I did it after you graduated.
Oh, I never knew you did monologues on this show.
Yep, I sure did. The Levy monologue. But fast forwarding, you know, Brandon and I have both been blessed with being able to work with some really, really, really wonderful people in the art world, in the theater world. And we've been able to cultivate relationships, both genuine as well as just professional working relationships. And it just so happened that Ruben Santiago Hudson, which is like a family member for us, you know, the uncle, the brother, long lost brother, is directing it at Two River. And Felicia Rashad, who's from Houston and actually knows my dad from Houston, doing theater in Houston briefly. I've worked with her before, and she's directing it here in L.A. And when I heard she was doing it, I gave her a call and said, hey, I love to just be considered for the role. And she ended up offering it to me.
Wow.
It's a little bit of both coincidence as well as and luck and blessings from the universe, as well as just both of us really wanting to do the role before we couldn't do it anymore.
I imagine that it's Ma Rainey's time to be seen again. I think it was, you know, premiered in New York was in 84, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
22 years ago. And so it probably started making the regional rounds shortly after that. So we're looking at almost 20 years before, you know, since it first made the regional theater rounds. So it seems like it's timely for this show to come back around in the national conversation. I think it's an incredibly fertile period for this play. We talk about the climate of America. We talk about appropriations, which is a hot topic today, and the way our country has been built on the texture, the artistic texture and the work of non-whites. And I think Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, that play certainly illustrates how our country has benefited and sometimes abused the impact that non-whites have made in the fabric of this country.
Yeah, it's definitely a totally relevant play, and you'll be doing it at exactly the same time, and obviously your brothers and very close. Are you planning to talk to each other as you approach the role, swap notes, discuss the rehearsal process, or are you just not going to touch on that subject at all?
No, we haven't talked or compared notes now. You know, I think, this is Brandon, by the way, I think that so much of I think so much of it is influenced by the room and then the director, the other actors. So we can talk about, you know, what August has on paper and that's not going to change no matter if it's me, Jason, or Peter down the street doing the role. You know, the facts of the character don't change.
Mm-hmm.
I think how this character responds in certain situations, the temperament of this character can be dictated by, for me, it's, as I approach acting, is dictated certainly by what my character wants, but also how other people treat him. Now, how Jason's supporting cast treats him and how my supporting cast treats me are going to be two different things because you got different people.
Mm-hmm.
So we discuss different moments of a play. It's kind of hard to say exactly what that moment is or what you want it to be, you know, without having the other people involved in that moment.
What about you? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Jason.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Brandon. It's, you know, you're influenced by the relationships you have with the other actors playing those characters.
Yeah.
So it's why, you know, you could see, you know, a totally different vision of the same play. And neither one is less truthful than the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, I may, you know, ask him a few things about, you know, certain moments as far as Levy, but overall it's going to be the production at the Mark Taper, and it's going to be the production at Two River Theater, you know?
Yeah. And this is kind of a different experience for you, because you both were in the piano lesson with, directed by Ruben Santiago Hudson at Signature Theater. And Brandon, you directed Jason in Seven Guitars at Two River. And what has it been like to work together on Wilson, on Works by Wilson?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm more comfortable, more familiar about working with Jason than not working with Jason when it comes to material. That's an interesting question. One thing that I know working with Jason, I can speak to that on August Wilson production or any show, working with Jason allows me a freedom that I usually take, that I can take for granted. I have such a freedom with him because I trust him. I trust his artistic sensibilities. I trust that he's prepared and he's going to show up on day one ready to run and not kind of jog through the paces. But we hit the ground running every time we do a show together. And that's not always a given with every company that you work with. Not everybody moves at the same pace. But we're kind of racehorses, and we like to get to the good stuff quickly. So I don't know. If his fellow castmates are listening, the ones who are going to be doing that, hey, you know, go to the gym, get your weight up, start in the treadmill, because this Jason's not going to, you know, he's not going to hold back for anybody. So, and I don't plan on doing it myself.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's, you know, the one thing that you really need in a room and during a process to have a great, great, great show and to tell a great story in a very honest, truthful way is to have that trust between the actors. And Brandon and I, you know, I've known him all my life, obviously, through the good and the bad times. But, you know, I trust him. I trust him as a person, and I trust him as an actor, and I trust him during the process. And that's maybe 60 to 70% of the battle right there. And that trust allows you to reach your potential, because you know you can throw a curveball at him and he'll still swing. He may hit or miss it, but he's still in the game with you. He's not going to stop and say, whoa. You know, you can always trust that he's there. You can trust that on stage, you know, you got your soldier with you, you know, and that's a very liberating process, and it allows you to explore even more than you thought than you had planned to, you know, and to just try different things, be a little more creative, take more risks, because you know, no matter what, you have your soldier next to you that's gonna ride with it. And then after rehearsal, we could talk about it and say, Jason, that was terrible. that's part of the artistic process. You're gonna be terrible some days. But you don't want to be embarrassed or feel embarrassed by being terrible, because everyone in the room knows that that's part of the process, and they trust that you're going to get there, and you trust that they're going to get there. And that's the joy of rehearsal and working on a show with somebody that you trust.
What was it like to be directed by Brandon?
It was horrible. He came in the process so unprepared. You know, I don't know if he had even read the play. No, it was absolutely, it was wonderful. And it was extremely, surprising. I was totally impressed every single day of rehearsal, especially the first day, because having worked with him and talked to him, I knew that he understood the play, and I knew that he could direct. But there's so many different elements to the process of directing that you haven't experienced until you experience it. You know, the different actors coming into the room and how they approach the process. And so handling all those different personalities is a skill in itself. And the way that Brandon commanded the room and set the tone for the environment of the room and the clarity of his vision was extremely impressive for a play like Seven Guitars. You know, this isn't, you know, Little Red Riding Hood. This is Seven Guitars by August Wilson. And there's so much, there's so many complexities to that story. And each character has so many levels, so full of depth. For him to be able to navigate it all without missing a beat, without any hiccups. Now, he may have had hiccups from the technical side and all the other stuff that the actors never have to deal with. But that never entered the room of, okay, we got a problem here and I don't know how to fix it. You know, it was such a collaborative, process. It was by no means a dictatorship. It was all love and all family. And he set that tone and I was absolutely impressed. It wasn't just this was really good for his first play. This is a really great show. And you know, as a brother, that makes you proud.
Yeah. What about you, Brandon? Does your experience having directed a play of August's inform now how you approach his work as an actor?
No. They're two totally different disciplines, I believe. Well, you know, that's not a correct answer. Yes, every experience influences the next experience. You know, and learning more about the community that August is writing about. Yes, but in terms of how I approach the work, I understand that as an actor, you got to be worried about what your character's worried about. You know, I cannot take care of other people on stage or other elements on stage. And when I try to take care of other elements on stage and other people on stage as an actor, I'm only in the way. But as a director, I have to take care of everybody. I have to give everybody, and that was my goal as a director. Every day I wanted to give everybody in the room, the actors, the stage managers, the technicians, everyone, everybody involved, their best opportunity to succeed in what it was they were doing. But I don't have that responsibility as an actor. So I can't say that in terms of the craft or the artistry of it, I can't say that directing it will influence how I am as an actor. I will say it influenced it. The opposite, though, was true. Like, as an actor in it, that certainly influenced me as a director. And it made me more patient with my other actor because I know how difficult it is to get those lines. August repeats himself a lot. And in a beautiful way, but it's repetitive and it can get you tripped up. And if you get on the wrong path that looks like another path, you know, when you're in act one, you can find yourself in act two somewhere and not know how to get back because some of the language is similar. So that gave me more patience as a director. And it also gave me tools to help actors navigate some of the longer speeches, and hit and find the musicality and find the purpose in the repetitive writing style. But as an actor, I gotta stay in my lane.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, you two both have similar educational and training backgrounds as well. You both went to Atlanta's Morehouse College and you went to graduate school at the University of Illinois. Do you find that you both approach work similarly as actors?
You know, I think so, but I don't know if it was the training, the institutional training received, or the home training received.
Yeah, right. Yes. You know, yeah, totally. Yeah, your dad's an actor.
Yeah, and he was our first, you know, acting coach. You know, he was the first one to have us rehearse in front of him and then fall asleep if he didn't believe us. You know, so, but he was always dropping jewels, you know, gems and acting philosophies of how he saw to approach acting and what he thought acting was. And a lot of that I still think about, still run in my head. But I'm sure we both, you know, especially University of Illinois in grad school, having the same professors, you know, we learn much of the same vocabulary in approaching the work. And I think one of the biggest things is preparation. The key for preparation, I think, there is where we actually have a similar idea of you know, not to complete the role, but just being prepared for the first day of rehearsal. And I'm sure, you know, if you put it side by side, there are some similarities, but, you know, also we're different people and have different energies. So you're going to find quite a few differences as well.
I think one thing that the educational background helped influence, especially Morehouse, is our responsibility as an artist, our responsibility to this community, our responsibility to the world, for the art, and be responsible for the art that we put out, for the work that we put out. I think that certainly has shaped our picture of, especially as men of color, as black men.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that's what August Wilson's work does. It tries to create a fuller picture of our experience in this country. And I know, coming from Morehouse College, that definitely is one of my goals, to give, through my art, is to give people a better understanding of all the complexities of humanity that we have as an African-American people.
Do both of you remember your first encounter with August Wilson's work, like the first time you saw a play on stage or something like that?
Yes. Brandon, help me remember, did the Alley do Ma Rainey before Joe Turner?
No, it did Joe Turner first.
Okay.
And next year was Ma Rainey.
So I saw Brandon do Joe Turner's Come and Gone at the Alley in Houston, and he played the young kid. I remember it, but I always say the first play that I really remember and hit me in a visceral way, and I didn't want to be an actor or anything, I just heard the play differently, was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And I don't know if it was the music in it or the musicality I heard in the dialogue, which I really didn't verbalize it that way because I didn't know what that's what I was hearing. But it was something about the play and about these gentlemen in this rehearsal room and the story that they were telling that really hit me in a visceral way. And I said, I like that. I really, really like that. It wasn't until four or five years later, because I was 11, I think. So it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years later that I said, okay, let me try this acting thing out. But Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is, like I said, the first play that really hit me in a way where I really understood the power of theater, and storytelling and putting representations of people and of culture on stage and how it can affect the audience.
Was Joe Turner your first experience, Brandon?
Yeah, I went in the Alley Theater in our hometown of Houston. I went to a performing arts middle school, and they called a bunch of us in, the kids from the middle school, to come and audition for A Christmas Carol. You know, the Cratchit kids and the Towns kids. And so I go in. I wasn't a great singer, so I got cut from the Christmas Carol list. But I was very disappointed. But they said, we got this other play that we're doing. Can you stick around and audition for this one? And that was Joe Turner's Come and Gone. This was 1990, I believe, 89, 90.
Wow.
And I had no idea who August Wilson was. But that in that production, Claude Purdy directed the production. He was one of August's best friends, and he actually got August. He was the one responsible for getting August to become a playwright as opposed to just a poet. And so he directed that production. The great, late great Roscoe Lee Brown played Bynum. And, oh, there was another actor in the show who said, remember the name August Wilson because one day he's going to feed your family.
That's a great quote.
And it's true. It's a great quote, but it was also prophetic.
Very.
Has that been true for you too, Jason?
I don't have a family, but it's been feeding me very well. Very well. Very well.
And I know both of you are obviously very close as brothers and very supportive of each other, and you've done a lot of great work with some of the same playwrights. I know you've both worked with Dominique Morisseau. You've both done a lot of work with August Wilson. Are you competitive at all as brothers? Maybe not for roles, but maybe in other things. You sound like you're both really hard workers and go after what you want. Are you competitive types?
You know, we are. We're healthy competition, number one. You know, we were raised in a home where it's always been the last name is more important than the first. So you always want to see your sibling do well, even if they're doing better than you, because it's really about the last name, that Durden. So you're striving to be great. And I said a couple of days ago, I never wanted Brandon to lose. I just wanted to win. So, so it's not like I want to win so Brandon can lose. It's just, I want to win and vice versa. But, luckily, the way the business has shaken down, for us, we've only auditioned for the same role once. I got it with George Murchison and Raising in the Sun, but he was already cast as Martin Luther King and All the Way on Broadway as well. So it wasn't like, would have been nice to be on the show with Denzel, but I'm doing Martin Luther King as well. And at the same time, and this is the first time where we were up for the same role and we could both play it. This is how it should work all the time, right? We both have the opportunity to play the role that we want to play.
Yeah.
But more than anything, more than the competition, we see the advantage it is to having love and support from your brother, because this business is hard as it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to navigate it on your own without that kind of brotherly love and support, it's extremely difficult. So we kind of have a leg up being able to call or text or, watch and support in a very, loving way, or help each other get that role. Help coaching or just work or whatnot. And so we don't take that for granted, that we're in a very blessed, special position to have the kind of relationship that we have with the healthy competition.
The thing about competition, and for Ms. Brandon, the thing about competition in the acting game, it's such a silly proposition to say I'm in competition with somebody else, right? This mm-hmm. is not a fair game. It's not like who scores the most points wins. It's not who runs the fastest wins. That is not, so it's really silly to compete with anybody, whether it's Jason or any other actor out there, right? You're not mm-hmm. competing for a role. The way you compete against yourself, acting is about being your best self. And at the end of the day, somebody else makes a decision to say that fits what my production or doesn't fit my production, right? It's not a fair fight. So why would you even try to compete with anyone? You compete with yourself, and I think that's the competition. We're challenging each other to be our best selves.
Did the two of you do a lot of plays together growing up when you were younger?
What did we do? One play together in high school?
What was that?
Ceremonies. Funny enough, yeah, we did Ceremonies of Dark Old Men. Ceremonies and Dark Old Men in high school. It was a senior, and I was a sophomore. And then my very first professional play, where I got my equity card, was Ceremonies and Dark Old Men.
Hell yeah.
Playing crazy.
The same roles. So in 1996, we did it in high school. And in 2007, we did it in Atlanta at Kenny Leon's Theater, True Colors. Which was really, for me, an extremely surreal moment, because in high school, in the theater that we were doing, we were reading books about the Negro Ensemble Company and the New Federal Theater, and reading about all these actors, African-American actors that we now see on TV, but really started in New York on stage in these acting companies. And for Ceremonies of Dark Old Men, we're working with Glenn Turman, who we've been reading about, and Eugene Lee, who we've been reading about in these books. And it was like, oh, wow, I'm working with you now. You're playing my dad.
Yeah.
I'm working with Glenn again in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But,
we did a few plays in college together.
We did.
Him. Born in the RSA.
Born in the RSA. Yeah.
That's so fun. And now you've gotten to do a few professionally as well.
Yeah.
What about, Levy is a trumpet player in the show. Are either of you musical? Do you play trumpet? Or you have to learn to play trumpet for the show?
Brandon, why don't you answer that question?
Jason's upset because he's in trumpet lessons twice a week.
I'm not upset. I'm not upset. It's just, it's a lot of work. I would say, but it's a challenge that I definitely welcome. I tell you, the play that Brandon directed, Seven Guitars, I had to learn how to play the harmonica over the summer before we started. And another play, I had to learn how to play the spoons. I already know how to play the saxophone. I played the saxophone for about 10 years when I was in grade school. And so I figured, you know, if this acting thing doesn't work out, I could be a one-man band and go on the road. But, it's extremely challenging. Not the reading of the music, because I still know how to read sheet music. It's the learning of how to play the instrument and strengthening muscles that you never used before, you know, in your mouth, your embouchure, and hitting those notes. But also, not just learning how to play it, because I got a pretty good handle on the songs themselves, but having the confidence that the character Levy has in playing this music, which is, you know, a great picture of who he is, very insightful of who he is as a person. And so moving from just learning how to play the trumpet to actually playing it with that kind of confidence and that kind of ego and bravado, it's what's challenging for me right now. And it'll come, you know, it'll definitely come, but that's where I am in the process. So, but I definitely welcome the challenge because I think it'll make my life easier as the character Levy. The instrument, what Felicia Rashad, you know, has preached is that the instrument itself is an extension of who you are as the character. You know what I mean? It's not just another thing. It's how you play it and what you want to do with the instrument is an extension of who you are in your life. And so it'll make my Levy that much more full and that much more honest to me, you know, and how to navigate the world. So, but it's challenging. I would say that.
What about you, Brandon? Are you in trumpet lessons?
No. Going along with what Jason said about the bravado, I don't think I have any problem with that. I don't think that's my issue as an actor in capturing brashness and the robust attack on life that Levy has. So I'm glad that Jason's discovering that through the trumpet. But I think
no. What I'm saying is I won't have a problem with doing it when I'm talking. It's having that same bravado and confidence while actually playing the music.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I'm gonna act. That's what I'm gonna do. Ruben Santiago Hudson, he has an incredible music team put together, led by Bill Sims Jr., who composes 99% of Ruben's plays, I mean, the music for Ruben's plays that he directs, and the trumpeter Kenny Rampton, who's a celebrated trumpet player. And Kenny is writing original music and is going to play, and Ruben wants, He wants intricate sound. He wants to sound professional. And that's always a trick when playing live music on stage. Now, if you're doing a play or musical like Once, right? That's part of the gimmick of it. Yeah, it's important that the actor's a musician. But in a play like this, it's a risky proposition that I think Felicia is making, and hopefully one that pays off when you have actors and you're trying to turn them into session musicians. If it works, it's going to be beautiful. But if that sound isn't right, I mean, you're taking the audience out of, you're taking them out of the play if the quality of the sound isn't right. So, she's cast some musicians I know, including Jason and another actor. So hopefully they're going to get that sound right. But Ruben didn't want to take that chance.
Yeah.
But you do lose, you know, you lose something in authenticity, you know, when you have pre-recorded music. So it's always a gamble, and it's about what's more important to you in the storytelling as a director. But that's a decision Ruben had to make, and I'm standing my lane. And I'm
yeah. No, that's great, and that's one of the differences between the two of your productions. So now I have a very important final question to end on. You two have, you obviously are different people as actors, but you have a lot of similarities. Jason, why don't you use a middle initial in your crediting?
Okay, here's the thing.
For those who don't know, Brandon is credited as Brandon J. Dearden.
You know, I never loved my middle name. Edward, I always felt like I had to be 47 before I could grow into that name, Edward. It's like King Edward, you know? So I was cool with Jason.
Good answer, good answer.
No, what's really fun that you asked this question, I was just thinking about this last week.
Really?
Yes. Not why he doesn't, but why do I use a J? It's not like my dad's name is, you know, Brandon either. You know, it's not. People, I was asking, why the J? Was there another J? Because sometimes when you join a union, if there's a, you know, somebody with your same name, you got to put your initial in. But that's not even the case. And I was always thinking, I knew it was something I did when I was a kid because I used to see my dad sign his name Willie J. Durden.
Uh huh.
Right. And I thought that was so cool to have that middle initial in your name. And so I started signing my name. When I started practicing my autographs, I started signing it with the J, Dirty. And it just, and it stuck. And I started thinking, well, do I still need it? And I said, yeah, to honor that kid in me that was so proud of doing it like his dad. And that kid in me who wanted to, you know, sign autographs for his fans. Yeah, I'm going to still keep signing, you know, with the J. I'm not going to change it.
Brandon, we all have pieces of our father in us, but Brandon, it's a consensus that Brandon is Willie, just younger. He's our father, just younger. Nobody else in my family uses their middle initial.
Really?
Nobody. It's Brandon and my dad. So I was going to say that, yeah, it's because he's like my dad. That's exactly why.
Oh, that's a high compliment.
I have no idea, you know, why, yeah, I do have an idea. I guess I just told you why.
Yeah. Do you have the same middle name as your dad?
No, I don't.
Just the same initial?
Same initial. His middle name is James. Mine is Joseph.
Okay.
Yeah. But I did not like Jason didn't care for his name, Edward. I did not care for my first name, Brandon. For the longest time, I didn't. And when I was young, I knew no older people named Brandon. So I used to think when I got old, I would get a different name. I thought Brandon was just a kid's name. Yeah, I remember one day asking my mom, when am I going to get my adult name? I remember that. But seriously, there were no kids. There were no older people named Brandon. And now there are Brandons everywhere.
Yeah.
But younger than myself. My age or younger.
Yep. Well, there's only one Brandon J. Dearden.
There you go.
Well, I think that's all I've got for you guys, unless there was something else the two of you wanted to chat about.
No, not.
See the shows.
And we're back with a few recommendations of things we've seen or read or thought about that we want to tell you about. Susie, you want to start? You have a good one?
Yeah, I do. 2 weeks ago, I spent the weekend up in Poughkeepsie at Vassar College for Vassar and New York Stage and Film's Powerhouse Theater. They have a partnership on the season. It's basically a big developmental hub up there where they workshop new plays. They have readings and workshops. They do a number of full productions each summer, but they're not a full production in the sense that they can't get reviewed, but they do completely stage them in the theater. So it's kind of like 2 weeks of previews, except you get like sets and designers. And they did a production of Sarah Delap's play, The Wolves, directed by Lila Neugenbauer.
I think it's Neugenbauer. I think.
Okay. She's fantastic. I need to learn how to pronounce her name. And I loved it. It was an amazing production. The cast was one of the best ensembles I've seen in a while. They really worked together really well. It's about a high school soccer team, an indoor soccer team. Well, they play outdoor soccer in the different seasons, but they're indoor. It was done on real AstroTurf. I believe they were all athletes. It was really, really moving play, and it's coming to Playwrights Realm in New York with the same cast, same directors, basically the same production, in September.
And so that's about a month from now, but I highly recommend it. So keep your eye out for it.
Cool. It won the Relentless Award,
award.
Right?
Award. Yeah, the Relentless Award, which was started at Labyrinth Theater Company for Phillips in memory of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah, and it was the first winner of that
David
award.
Barkat started that. I've heard that her name and that about that play for a while now. And I'm really looking forward to it.
It's great. It's a good production too. Lila did a really great job.
Yeah, I have the script. It's super hard to read, though.
Well, all the characters don't have names. They're all numbered, so it's kind of impossible to read on the page. Huh. But it's great in production.
Huh. Interesting. A lot for a director to do there, I guess. Mm-hmm. Deep.
So this morning, I had Young Jean Lee playing in the background because she made almost her entire archive of work on video available on youngjeanlee.org. And so fun story, when I first got to American theater, I was flipping through old copies of the magazine and I saw this play script by this Asian American female writer I've never heard of, and I did not know Asian American female playwrights existed, and it was called Songs of the Dragon Flying to Heaven by Young Jin Lee. It was one of her first works, mm-hmm. and it starred Jennifer Lean Preach-English, and the play was back in 2008 when it was done at here, and I was so sad that I never got to see it because I was not old enough to be in New York at the time, and now I can because it's on youngjeanlee.org. And then I was listening to her do, you know, we're gonna die with her band Future Wife,
right.
This like cabaret show about existential fears, and it was really personal, and I had it running in the background because it's kind of like a TED Talk / podcast. You don't really need to look at her. It's just great, but a great way for you to like think about your own fears about dying, which I'm thinking about a lot these days.
Wow.
So I recommend that. And there's also a version of We're Gonna Die performed by Young Jean Lee and David Byrne.
Yeah, from the Meltdown Festival last year. Now, I noticed there's she even has straight white men from the public.
Yes. I don't even know how she did it, so I'd have to find it
out. To do the
out.
Rights for that. I mean, yeah. But that one and the David Byrne one are not embeddable elsewhere. You can't. They're only watchable on her site. The other ones, which she must have gotten the rights for, I know the Shipman has been available
On the boards,
and I think it's because those are non-equity shows, right? A lot of those were, or they didn't have an equity agreement, so she was able to tape them and share them. Is what I understood. I'm not sure if that's 100%.
I don't know.
True.
I feel like Songs of the Dragon Flying to Heaven. I hear like they use equity actors, so I'm not entirely sure. But the only show that's not available on her website is Untitled Feminist Show, and probably because of nudity, because
it's just women naked
dancing
the whole time. And I can understand fair use, you know, don't want to put that out in the world just for free for anyone to look at.
But I'm very excited to go through the archives because, you know, theater is transient. And unless you live in New York City and can go to Lincoln Center and see theater on tape, it's very hard to see something that is not coming to your town. And so this is a great way of making it available to a wider audience.
I was struck by how far back. It goes well back before that play. I forget the name of the play. There's one play with Tom Bradshaw in it. There's it's some fascinating stuff. It's some of the and a lot of the video quality is really quite good.
Yeah, the We're Gonna Die at Lincoln Center, maybe because it was at Lincoln Center, but the camera work is really good on that one.
But
there's multiple cameras.
I looked at her play Church, which actually one of our new TCG employees, Corinne, in the books division is in, and it was really good. And I think that was done just at here or PS122. I second your recommendation, if I may. Speaking of videos, we're actually going to share the shipment in a new feature on our Facebook page, American Theater Facebook page. If you're not already following it, you might want to. Every Saturday, we're going to share a long-form video of some kind from the internet. Last week, we shared part one of a 9-part series, which is all on the internet, of John Barton's famous Shakespeare classes, which were taped for some for some reason, I think by BBC. Anyway, mm-hmm. that's all online. It's an amazing like masterclass in Shakespeare. And then speaking of Shakespeare, this past Saturday there's a video of the entire complete works of William Shakespeare by the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Oh my God, I was addicted to that at UCLA. So it was so fun.
The original is up online.
Yes,
and
yes.
I wrote the article about it for the Daily Bruin when I was at UCLA.
So the shipment will be up in a couple weeks. We actually welcome, if you've got any, to send them to us, links to full-length plays or documentaries or specials, something longer than a quick hit, so people on the weekend will have some theater-related video to watch. I think that'll be my recommendation for today. I just want to say briefly, there was a fascinating essay by Noah Millman in the New Republic about the three recent revivals of mid-century American works, both of Ivo van Hove's View from the Bridge of the Crucible and Benedict Andrews, I think is his name, the Australian production of Streetcar. He liked all those productions better than I did, except for View, which I did like. But he made a really interesting point about how much those plays resonated now in the way that Shakespeare plays do, that now the mid-century is far enough away that we just treat it as a distant past, and we are looking for, in the way most directors of Shakespeare do now, what do these characters mean to us now? Make it as immediate as possible. And he praises that and also says, what are we missing about the way the play was received? That plays might have still a role in teaching us about the past in which they were created. So it's an interesting thought-provoking essay, which I hadn't really thought of in that way. Look for that Noah Millman, New Republic. I forget the title of it, but it's called Mid-Century Modern. I highly recommend that essay. So on that note, like us on Facebook, follow us on iTunes. Review us on iTunes, yes.
And links to the things we talked about will be on the podcast page on americantheater.org.
Sounds good. Till next time.